With the holiday of Purim, as with all Yomim Tovim, there is a tendency to get caught up with all the details, which is a good thing. We get involved in all the details of Purim. That would be hearing the Megillah and taking care of the Shalach Manos and the costumes and the Seuda, the meal, and the Matanos Avyonim, all the gifts to the poor. We get so involved in these details, which is the way it's supposed to be with Yomim Tovim, but frequently, because we're involved in the details, we lose sight of the bigger picture. We see the trees and miss the forest. And what I would like to do tonight is to give you something to focus on over Purim, so that you can see the bigger picture, even when you're involved in the details of Purim itself. But nevertheless, to keep in mind the bigger picture, so that throughout the day, you can be building on something, and that by the time the day is over, you will feel, when Purim is over, that you have taken something from the day. The day has changed your life, has brought something into your life, and that you can take it with you after Purim. In order to do that, we have to understand what Purim is all about. Now, I remembered that last year I gave a talk to women about Purim, and when I was preparing this afternoon, I was remembering this, and I looked back on my palm pilot to see when I spoke last year, and it turns out that last year, tonight is of course February 28th, last year on February 28th, we had a pre-Purim talk here in Atlanta. I was visiting Atlanta one day, and it was Rosh Chodesh Adar last year on February 28th, and we had a pre-Purim talk. So, it is not Rosh Chodesh Adar, but it is nearly Purim. It's the same secular date, and we have our pre-Purim talk. Now, last year, we discussed a certain aspect of Purim, and we need to begin tonight the same way we started last year, because the basics still are the way I'm going to begin. But then we're going to spin it off in a different direction, and we will have a completely different approach to Purim this year than we did last year. Now, the basic point of Purim, which is true no matter what approach you're going to take, but you have to start with this, is that Purim features a bad guy, whose name is
Haman.
And Haman is the representative of what bad nation?
Amalek.
Which is why we read Parsha Zohar, the Shabbos before Amalek, this coming Shabbos. In just a few days, we're going to read Parsha Zohar. That's because of Amalek. So it features Amalek, and it features two good guys, or good people, we should say. And they are?
Mordechai and
Esther. Who come from which tribe?
Binyamin.
So the Yontif of Purim features Binyamin against Amalek. And no matter which way you're going to spin Purim, and how you're going to look at it, you have to start with Binyamin and Amalek. Those are the two that we have to deal with in order to understand Purim. Now, Binyamin and Amalek is nothing new. In this coming Shabbos Haftorah, the Haftorah which we're going to say for Parsha Zohar, we read about which king eradicating or attempting to eradicate Amalek? Shaul. King Saul is attempting to eradicate Amalek, attempting to fulfill the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek. And Shaul comes from which tribe?
Binyamin.
From Binyamin. So again, you see the Binyamin-Amalek rivalry. And that follows through throughout history. The Binyamin-Amalek rivalry is a thought that I heard many, many years ago from one of my Rebbeim in Neri Yisrael, Rav Shaftel Neuberger, who pointed out that you always find that Binyamin is the one charged with defeating Amalek. What he pointed out, and then I will tell you how I added to what he said, but what he pointed out is that the Gemara says, the Talmud says, that the children of Esav will only be given over, which means they'll only be defeated by the children of Rachel. We know that we had Rachel and Leah were the matriarchs, were the mothers of the tribes, and Leah, most of the tribes come from Leah. Rachel has two tribes, Yosef and Binyamin, and the children of Esav can only be defeated by the children of Rachel, by Yosef and Binyamin. And therefore, the Gemara even says that in Sefer Shmuel Beis, when David HaMelech, King David, defeats Edom, Edom is Esav, when he defeats Esav, the Gemara says, how is that possible? David is from Yehuda, and he's not from Yosef, he's not from Manasseh or Ephraim, so how could he have defeated Edom and defeated Esav? And the Gemara says that there must have been that his officers, his chiefs of war, were from Manasseh or from Ephraim. I think the Gemara says from Manasseh, actually. And so that justifies how he could have defeated Esav, how he could have defeated Edom. It is therefore a given in the Gemara that have to be children of Rachel in order to defeat Esav, in order to defeat Edom. We are in Golos Edom right now. The exile we are in is the exile of Edom. Rome was the representative of Edom in the world, and therefore that is where we find ourselves. We need the children of Rachel to defeat Edom. But what Rabbi Neuberger pointed out is that although the children of Rachel are the ones who will defeat Edom, but Edom, Amalek is a subset of Edom. Amalek is a descendant of Esav. And that specific part of Edom, the Amalek part, has to be defeated only by Binyamin. And the reason for this is that back in Parshas Vayishlach, when Yaakov and his children meet Esav, then what do they all do?
Bow.
They all bow to Esav. And the only one who does not bow is Binyamin, because he wasn't born yet. Binyamin wasn't yet born, and therefore he didn't bow to Esav. Since he didn't bow to Esav, therefore he has the power to defeat the worst of Esav. And the worst of Esav is, of course, Amalek. In fact, there is a Purim reference to this non-bowing, and that is? Okay. It says in Mordechai, what does it say? Right, it says in Mordechai, in the Megillah, it says in Mordechai, lo yichrav lo yishtachavah. Mordechai would not bow to Haman, although everybody else did. And the Gemara says, why not? Because Mordechai came from Binyamin, and Binyamin didn't bow to Esav. Mordechai will not bow to Haman. We're going to come back to that. We'll tie that in later on. So there is that strength. This is what Rabbi Neuberger suggested, that strength of Binyamin, that he never bowed to Esav, gives him the power to defeat the worst of Esav, which is Amalek. The first encounter we have with Amalek, which is at the end of Parshas Bishalach, which is the reading for Purim morning. In that encounter, it says, Vayavo Amalek, Vayilachem in Yisrael b'Refidim. Amalek came and fought with Yisrael in Refidim. Before we got the Torah, we had a war with Amalek. Who led the battle against Amalek? Anybody remember? It wasn't Moshe. Moshe says, Vayomer Moshe, to Yehoshua. Yehoshua, he says to Yehoshua, you go lead the battle. Moshe goes up the mountain and raises his hands up so they can all see his hands up to heaven, and that way they can think about Hashem during the war. But Yehoshua leads the battle. What tribe is Yehoshua from? He's not from Binyamin. Yehoshua is from Ephraim, from Yosef. So he is from the children of Rachel, which does fit. It has to be from the children of Rachel. However, he is not from Binyamin. And at the very end, they defeat Amalek. The Jews defeat Amalek. Yehoshua is successful in defeating Amalek. But it only says, Vayachalosh Yehoshua, es Amalek ves Amalek Picharev. Yehoshua weakened Amalek. He did not wipe them out. Rashi comments over there, why didn't he wipe them out? He could have wiped them out right there. We could have been finished right there. No more Amalek. Yehoshua could have taken care of them right there on the spot. But he didn't do it. And Rashi says that it must have been a direct command from Hashem, but that was not the time to wipe them out. But what Rabbi Neuberger pointed out is that Yehoshua was from Yosef, not from Binyamin, and therefore he could not have been the one to wipe them out. It has to be the Binyamin descendants to wipe out Amalek, not the Yosef descendants. Although Yosef can defeat Amalek, because Yosef can defeat Edom, but only Binyamin can defeat Amalek. They can destroy Amalek. And that's why King Saul is the one who is charged with destroying Amalek, although he fails. And it is Mordechai and Esther, who come from Binyamin in the Purim story, who are the heroes who defeat Haman, who comes from Amalek. Yeah.
Is there a reason they have to be from Binyamin?
Well, that's what he said, because Binyamin didn't bow. And that gives Binyamin, right, that's the strength that Binyamin has to defeat the worst of Edom. So you have this rivalry, and of course, if that's the way it's been throughout history, we can expect it in the future as well. We don't know how events are going to play out. as history continues and we wait for Mashiach to come. But we know that part of the future is going to bring the demise, the destruction of Amalek, and we can expect that there will be a descendant of Binyamin who will be the one directly involved in destroying Amalek. However that is going to play itself out, of course, we don't know. So, however you're going to approach Purim, you have this rivalry to deal with. Last year, we focused on the word derech, on the road, because Amalek attacks Baderech. And Binyamin, Yaakov doesn't want to send them with the brothers, Baderech. He doesn't want to send them on the road. Rachel dies in childbirth, giving birth to Binyamin, Biderech Ephras, on the way to Ephras. Everything involves the road, involves traveling. That's what we spoke about last year, and if any of you who were there, you may recall, we made a distinction between Biderech and Baderech, a road and the road. That was last year's talk. I see blank faces, which means maybe it will be next year's talk as well. But for this year, it was a whole talk last year. We can save it for another year. This Baruch Hashem, we have plenty of forums, and we'll have plenty of talks. But for tonight, we're going to take a different focus with this rivalry of Binyamin and Amalek, and we're going to tie it into Purim directly, and we're going to show how to focus on the day of Purim, as I mentioned before, to take something concrete out of the day. There is a very telling Rashi in Sefer Shoftim, and this Rashi, to me, is one of the most revealing statements of Chazal of our sages. It at first would seem has nothing to do with our discussion at all. But we will show how it directly impacts what we're talking about. There's a famous medrash that the kids actually sing a song about. I've mentioned this in various talks before. Some of you may have heard this before. It's one of my most favorite statements of Chazal. And the song that the kids sing, Shavuos time, is all about how there were different mountains who wanted to be the mountain that the Torah would be given on. But little Har Sinai is the one who didn't come and didn't brag, and therefore little Har Sinai is the one that the Torah was given on. Which is a nice song, and of course the song is based in truth. But the Medrash is much more specific. The Medrash actually says that there were two other mountains that were in the running for the Torah to be given on them. Not just Har Sinai, but two other ones. Anybody know the other two? Famous mountains in Jewish history. Okay, good. That's a good guess. That is a famous mountain. But not Har Gerizim and not Har Evo, and not Har HaBayis either, not Har HaMoriah, where the Beis HaMikdash is. What's that? Har HaKarmel. Har HaKarmel is one. We'll describe that in a moment. And Har Tavor is the other one. Har HaKarmel is one. Har Tavor is the other one. Mount Carmel and Mount Tavor. Those are the two other mountains that were in the running for the Torah to be given on them. There are significant stories that take place, one on Har Tavor and one Har HaKarmel. Anybody know the stories that take place on each of these mountains?
Have to do with brothers?
No. Okay, Har HaKarmel was the face-off between Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, and the false prophets of the Baal, which we'll describe in more detail in a moment. But that story happens on Mount Carmel, Har HaKarmel. Har Tavor, that's the story of Devorah and Barak. The song of Devorah, that the war they had with Sisera, that's Har Tavor. That takes place on Har Tavor. Yeah. Now, this Barak, Devorah and Barak, those are the two, right?
They're not in the desert.
They're not in the desert, that's correct. That's correct. I don't know what it would have meant, whether Jews would have gone to Israel. I have no idea what would have happened had the Torah been given on either of those mountains. The Torah wasn't given on those mountains, so we don't know. But those were the other two mountains that were, so to speak, in the running. In other words, when Hashem was going through mountains to decide which mountain was the right one for the Torah, there were three that made the final cut. And of those three, Har Sinai won out over the other two. But the other two were in the running. Now what does that mean, that they were in the running? So first let me read to you what Chazal say. Chazal say as follows. In the song of Devorah, in Shiras Devorah, she says, Anochi la Hashem, Anochi Ashira. I to Hashem, I will sing. Now this word Anochi harkens back to a different Anochi What's the more famous Anochi? Okay, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God, which was said in the beginning of the Ten Commandments of the Aseret HaDibros on Har Sinai. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. So here, there on Har Sinai, Anochi is used once. I am Hashem your God. But on Har Tavor, in the story of Devorah, it says, Anochi Lahashem Anochi Ashira. I to Hashem I will sing. In other words, Anochi is used twice. And so, the question is, what is the significance of using the word Anochi twice? And so listen to what Rashi says. Rashi says,
Shamati Medrash Agada. I heard a Medrash. Lo kiper HaKadosh Baruch Hu Schar Tavar VeKarmel. Hashem did not hold back the reward for the mountains of Tavar and Carmel. Shebo'u L'matan Torah, that they came to Matan Torah, whatever that means, they came to Matan Torah. Lases Aleim Es HaTorah, that the Torah should be given on them. They wanted the Torah to be given on them. V'chazu B'boshes HaPanim, but they left with dejected faces, meaning they were turned away. Hashem said, no, the Torah is not going to be given on either of you. But Hashem did not hold back their reward, because since they were in the running, and since they wanted to do a good thing, they wanted the Torah to be given on them, so Hashem says, you're going to get rewarded. Amar lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to them, Sof in the end, Shani Porea Lachem Kiflayim, I'm going to pay you back double. I'll give you back double what you wanted. Ne'emar b'Sinai, it says regarding Har Sinai, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God. B'Tavor, Ne'emar, or Yomar, with Tavor it will say, Anochi, Anochi. It says Anochi twice, not just once, but twice. So Tavor got a double portion of Anochi, of I, whatever that means. Ne'emar b'Sinai Anochi Hashem Elokecha, on Har Sinai says, I am Hashem your God. And b'Karmel, on Har HaKarmel with Eliyahu and the false prophets, Yomar Kofel, it says it twice, Hashem Hu Ho Elokim, Hashem Hu Ho Elokim, Hashem, He is the God, Hashem, He is the true God. What's that? Which we say at the end of Yom Kippur, very good. Okay. Now, this medrash does not mean, one should not get the impression that it means that mountains can have free will, or that mountains can talk, or that mountains have reward and punishment. Of course, that's not so. They don't have free will, they don't talk, they don't have reward and punishment. But what the medrash means is as follows. The medrash means that these mountains represent something. Each one of these mountains, Carmel, Tavor, and Sinai, each represents a different attribute, a different trait. And each one of these traits, one may have thought, is the most important trait for which the Torah is given. That's what one may have thought. That each one of these traits is in the running. You might have thought each one of these traits is the thing that you need, that's most important for the giving of the Torah. And what Hashem says is that no, Har Sinai's trait is the one that is most important for the giving of the Torah. The other two each also have a trait that they represent, which are important for other things, but not for the giving of the Torah. What is the trait that that Har Sinai represents? Azanivus is humility. That's what the song. Little Har Sinai didn't come and say, I'm the biggest, I'm the strongest. It's a small mountain. Because what Hashem is bringing out is that if you want to be kaina Torah, you want to acquire Torah, the only way to do that is through humility. Humility is the most important trait when it comes to the acquisition of Torah. What do the other two mountains represent? So the other two mountains, and we don't have the time to develop both mountains, unfortunately, but we're going to have to use the one that is relevant to Purim, which is going to be Har HaKarmel, which is the one with Eliyahu. Har Tavor is going to have to wait for a different talk, perhaps a Pesach talk at the end of Pesach. It has to do with the seventh day of Pesach, perhaps a Shavuos talk, but tonight we're going to have to focus only on Har HaKarmel. But the other two mountains represent Carmel and Tavor. Represent Tavor, you know what? I'm not even going to say what they represent because each one is... Okay, I'll throw it there. But I can't explain them. I don't have the time now to develop each one. Tavor represents Teshuvah.
Tavor represents teshuva, and Carmel represents, you know what, you're going to see tonight what Carmel represents. That's what tonight's talk is going to be about, what Carmel represents. You'll see, okay? You'll see what it represents. No, you're going to see. Listen, this way you'll keep listening, you know, otherwise I'm not sure. Now, we know that the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, in Ethics of the Fathers, that we Jews, we have three separate crowns. There are three crowns of the Jewish people. We spoke about this in a talk recently, that there are three crowns of the Jewish people. There is, of course, the crown of royalty, but there are two other crowns. Anybody know the two other crowns? Okay, the crown of Kahuna, the priesthood, and the crown of Torah. The crown of Torah. Those are the three crowns. Torah, Kahuna, which is the priesthood, and Malchus, and royalty. These three mountains each correspond to one of those crowns. Har Sinai, of course, corresponds to the crown of Torah. What else would that represent other than Torah? The other two, and again, we're going to only develop one of these two because we can't develop both, but Har Tavor is corresponds to the crown of royalty, and Har HaKarmel represents Kehuna, represents the priesthood. So what we need to do right now is to show what Har HaKarmel is all about, how it represents the priesthood, what is the attribute it represents, what does that have to do with Purim, and then tie it back into the Megillah. So this is what we're going to do with the remaining time that we have. Okay, this was all introduction. Okay. Okay. Now, what happened on Har HaKarmel? I realize it sounds very disjointed, but it's all going to come together. Trust me. Now, what happened on Har HaKarmel? Har HaKarmel, we had it was a time in the time of the Jewish people when idolatry was rampant. And it was during the reign of Ahav and Jezebel, who were both evil, and they supported and endorsed idolatry, specifically the Baal, the idolatry of Baal and also Asherah, and Jezebel also killed out the Nevi'im, the prophets of the Jewish people. Eliyahu HaNavi was the Navi, he was the prime prophet of the time, and he was the one who fought against Ahav and Jezebel. And it came to a head as a face-off, as a contest on Har HaKarmel. And on Har HaKarmel, on this mountain, they got together all the Jewish people on this mountain, which is up in the north, and Eliyahu had them bring two bulls, and he said to the false prophets of the Baal, "You take one bull, I'll take another bull, we'll each build an altar, we will slaughter each of our bulls, we will put them on top of the altar, and we will not put any fire to the bulls. Then we will cry out to God, you will cry out to the Baal, I will cry out to Hashem, and whichever God brings down fire to consume the bull, that proves who the real God is." And they readily agreed, and they went about this contest. And so the Baal, they started, the prophets of the Baal, and they slaughtered their bull, and they built an altar, and they put the bull on top of the altar, and then they cried out to Hashem, to the Baal, and they said, "Oh Baal, answer us, Baal, answer us!" And they screamed and yelled, and they cut themselves, and they did all kinds of things in order to get the Baal to answer them. Of course, the Baal did not answer them. Eliyahu HaNavi, this is a side point, Eliyahu HaNavi made fun of them while they were trying to do this, and he said to them, "Oh, well, maybe your God is, maybe he took a trip. Maybe he's sleeping and you need to wake him up. Maybe he's in the bathroom." And so he made fun of their idolatry. The Gemara points out from here, from that episode, that all leitzanusa, all cynicism, is not appropriate. It is not a good trait to be cynical and to speak with cynicism, except about idolatry. About idolatry, it is the correct thing to do, to be cynical and to put down and be disparaging about idolatry. You see that from Eliyahu, the way he made fun of their idolatry. At any rate, of course they were not answered. Then Eliyahu takes his bull and slaughters his bull and puts it up on the altar. And when he puts it up on the altar, he says, Aneni Hashem, Aneni, answer me, Hashem, answer me. And fire came down from the heavens, consumed his bowl, consumed the other bowl. He had also asked that water be poured all over the place. And the fire came down and consumed all the water. It killed some of the people that were the evil people there, etc. And the Jews were so awestruck by what happened that they called out, Hashem hu ho Elokim, Hashem hu ho Elokim. Hashem is the true God, Hashem is the true God, which is what we say at the end of Ni'ilah on Yom Kippur. 7 times we say Hashem hu ho Elokim, hearkening to that story. That's what happened on Har HaKarmel. However, there is a very interesting verse over there at Har HaKarmel. I mentioned this last year, I believe. And that is that when Eliyahu HaNavi goes to build the altar, it says, "Va'yirape es mizbach Hashem heharus." He didn't build a new altar from scratch. It says he repaired the altar of Hashem that had been destroyed. He repaired the altar of Hashem that had been destroyed. Now that begs the question, because we're talking about the mountain of Carmel, not where the Beit HaMikdash is. And so, what altar of Hashem that had been destroyed? What altar of Hashem was there that he repaired? Anybody know what altar it's talking about? What's that? No, not Yaakov Lamar. Okay, so this is where you see, Here's where we're going to see our first connection with Purim. I'll ask you to please turn to the Haftorah for Parashat Zachar, which is this Shabbos' Haftorah, which is on page 1214 and 1215. Where geographically did Amalek live relative to Israel? In what part of Israel, what part of Eretz Yisrael did Amalek live? The pasuk says, Amalek yoshev be'eretz. No. Hanegev. They live in the south. That's part of the connection between Amalek and Binyamin. Binyamin is called Binyamin because it means son of the south. Binyamin, Yamin is to the south. Those are the directions we've spoken about in Yechezkel. Yamin is the south. So Binyamin is the south, and Amalek is the south. That's one of the connections. But at any rate, so Amalek is in the south. Shaul goes to kill out Amalek. He's told by Hashem, Shmuel tells Shaul, it's time to go kill out Amalek, and he goes. And he kills out Amalek, and he thinks he's done the job. Of course, we know he failed because he left alive the king, Agag, and also a lot of the animals. But he thinks he's done the job. Now, he does it in the south of Eretz Yisrael, which is where Amalek is. But then, Hashem appears to Shmuel that night and says to Shmuel, I've regretted what I've done, says Hashem. I wish I never would have made Shaul king. Of course, Hashem doesn't change his mind, whatever that means. But he says that, it's not a good thing. Shaul should never have been king. Because he blew it. He didn't do what he was supposed to do. Now, of course, you know, Shaul was an extremely righteous person, a very pious person, himself the greatest person, the greatest Jew, the most worthy Jew of being king at that time. Unfortunately, he did not rise to the challenge over here. And of course, you know that anytime we speak of the sins of the righteous, we don't mean to say, chas v'shalom, that they were in any way on our level. If had we been there, we would have sinned too. Believe me, if he did, then certainly we would have. He was way higher level than we are. So, however we're going to understand his sin, and that's really a separate talk of exactly what his sin was, to understand the kingdom of Shaul versus the kingdom of David, etc., is a whole different talk. But at any rate, he didn't do the job. But he thought he did. Hashem tells Shmuel, you need to go to Shaul and tell him that he made a mistake. So Shmuel wakes up early in the morning, and he goes to Shaul. So the verse says, it's Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12. Vayashkem Shmuel likras Shaul baboker. Shmuel got up early to greet Shaul in the morning. Vayugad li Shmuel lemar. It was told to Shmuel saying, Ba Shaul ha Carmela. Shaul has come to Carmel. V'hinei matziv lo yad. And behold, he is erecting an altar. V'yisov v'yavar v'yered ha-Gilgal. And then he turned and came down to the Gilgal. So Shaul went from the south of Eretz Yisrael, where he thought he had successfully wiped out Amalek, to the north of Eretz Yisrael, to Mount Carmel, and builds an altar. And it is then Shmuel approaches Shaul and tells him, you made a mistake, you didn't do it, you didn't successfully complete the job. What on earth is Shaul doing going to the north of Eretz Yisrael, to the Mount Carmel, after wiping out Amalek? What does Har HaCarmel have to do with anything? And Rashi tells us in Sefer Melachim, with the story of Eliyahu on Har HaCarmel, and that pasuk I mentioned before, Vayirapeas Nizbach Hashem HaHarus, he repaired the altar of Hashem that had been destroyed. Rashi says, this is the altar. The altar that Shaul had built, representing the destruction of Amalek, the successful destruction of Amalek, but it wasn't really realized. That had been laid in disrepair because Shaul didn't really finish the job. Now Eliyahu on that mountain of Carmel repairs that same Mizbeach, and that's where he has the contest with the false prophets of the Baal. What is the connection? What is the connection? What is going on with the mountain of Carmel? What is the connection with Shaul, with Eliyahu? And most importantly, what is the Mida, what is the trait that this mountain represents? Amalek. Ayin, Mem, Lamed, Kuf. The gematria of Amalek, the numerical value, is 2. Right, that's right, good, excellent. It's 240. 240 is the same gematria as Safek, which means doubt. Amalek's power is in the power of doubt. Amalek does not have power to attack and destroy and wipe out. Amalek is not an all-powerful nation. Amalek's power is the power of doubt, of Safek. Right before Amalek attacks us, in Parashas V'shalach for the first time, and we're going to read it on Purim morning, right before they attack, the Jews have the episode with the water, where there's no water to drink, and they fight and argue with Moshe, and Moshe has told them to hit the rock, which he does. That's the first time when he was supposed to hit the rock, and he does, and water comes out. And over there it says that the Jews, they tested Hashem, and they said, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu imayim. Is God in our midst or not? Not God not in our midst. There was a doubt. Is God in our midst or not? And then the next pasuk says, Vayavo Amalek, Amalek comes. When there's doubt, that's where Amalek comes. Amalek's power is in the doubt. Yes?
What's the name of the two places where he doesn't hit the rock and he does hit the rock?
There's Masa Umeriva. Uh-huh. And there is, that's what it is, Meriva and Kadesh. Meriva's Kadesh. But Masa Umeriva is where the first one is. Masa Umeriva. At any rate, you have this, that is Amalek's power. We all know the famous Medrash with Amalek, that Amalek is compared to the fool who, there's a tub of very hot water, and nobody wants to go in the tub. It's too hot, the water's too hot. So there's a fool who says, I don't care, I'll jump in. And he jumps in and scalds himself, but he cools off the water. Because when people see that someone can do it, now already the tub is approachable. The Jews were invincible. In the eyes of all the nations, when we left Egypt, and all the plagues that happened to the Egyptians, and then the splitting of the sea, nobody would touch us. Everybody was terrified of the Jewish people. Nobody would dare approach the Jewish people to attack. Amalek knew they would lose if they would attack, but they attacked anyway. Why? Because they want to sow the seeds of doubt. Show people it's not impossible to attack the Jewish people. You may lose, but then you may win. You might lose many times, but eventually you might win. There's a doubt. They put a crack in the armor. They don't destroy the armor. They create the seeds of doubt. When we have doubt about our belief in Hashem, Amalek has room to come in and make doubt in the eyes of all the nations of whether or not we are invincible, whether or not we are the people of Hashem, whether or not we are the ones who represent Hashem in this world.
That is the power of Amalek, and that's where Amalek has its power. When Shaul thought that he had destroyed Amalek, he went to the mountain of Carmel. Why the mountain of Carmel? Because the mountain of Carmel represents what trait? The trait of complete and total faith in Hashem. Without any doubt, without any suffix, without any room for any sort of question about Hashem's existence, about Hashem's being all-powerful, all-good, everything, that is what the mountain represents. The mountain of Carmel, the trait it represents, is complete and total faith, without any doubt at all. That is why the face-off between Eliyahu and the false prophets of the Baal takes place on Mountain of Carmel. Because what happens over there? You know what happened over there? Eliyahu says to the Jewish people, he says to them, you're not all idolaters. He says to them, Ad masai atem poschim al shnei hasi'ifim. Until when are you going to straddle the fence? Until when are you going to be going on both sides? Im Hashem hu ha'elokim l'chu ha'harav. If Hashem is God, go after him. Im ha'baal hu ha'elokim l'chu ha'harav. And if the Baal is God, then go after him. What do you do? How can you worship both Hashem and the Baal? It's either or. You can't worship God and also idolatry. It's one or the other. The Jews were not clear. They weren't sure. There was a doubt. There wasn't a rejection of Hashem. There was a doubt. The face-off between the two of them, in that contest, when that was over, it removed the doubt. And the Jews proclaimed fully, without any doubt, Hashem hu ho Elokim. Hashem hu ho Elokim. Hashem is the true God. Hashem is the true God. Without a doubt. That's what that mountain represents. That's why when Shaul destroys Amalek, he goes to build an altar on that mountain. Because since Amalek represents suffix, represents doubt, the place to go when you've eradicated Amalek, if you were successful, is to that mountain, to the mountain of Carmel, which represents complete and total faith in Hashem without a doubt at all. And that is what the connection is between the mountain of Carmel and wiping out Amalek. And that's why the story of Eliyahu takes place on the mountain of Carmel. What about Purim?
But he knew he didn't destroy the
Ark. He thought he had fulfilled the word of Hashem. He didn't realize that leaving the king alive was not fulfilling the word of Hashem. He thought he had done it.
Are we leaving the king alive,
you have the heir of the hand of Haman. That's right. Haman comes from that. Haman ha from leaving Agag alive comes Haman. That's correct. We said before that these three mountains also represent different crowns. Har Sinai represents the crown of Torah. Har Tavor represents the crown of Malchus, of royalty. And Har HaKarmel represents that of Kehuna, of the Kohen Gadol, of the high priest of the priesthood. Eliyahu was from what tribe? There's actually a difference of opinion about this. But Eliyahu, many authorities say Eliyahu is the same person as Pinchas. Pinchas is the grandson of Aaron HaKohen. Pinchas himself was the Kohen Gadol in his time. And so Eliyahu himself is Kuhuna, is the priesthood. And that's Har HaKarmel. Now, if Amalek represents doubt, and Har HaKarmel represents the total and complete faith in Hashem without a doubt, the antithesis of Amalek, of doubt, of suffix, then Binyamin, who we've established, is the adversary of Amalek, is the one that defeats Amalek, must also represent total and complete faith in Hashem without a doubt. In whose portion is the Beis HaMikdash built?
Binyamin.
In Binyamin's portion. That is not by accident. Binyamin and Kehuna
are cut from the same cloth. Binyamin and the Beis HaMikdash and the Kohuna, the priesthood, all are cut from the same cloth. You know, the Purim story, after we win the war, because of the heroes Mordechai and Esther, a short time later results in what? The building of the second temple, the rebuilding of the temple. The second commonwealth is heralded in by the Purim story with Mordechai and Esther. Now, the second Beis HaMikdash, we had Kohuna. We had, it was restored. The crown of Kohuna came back. We had the priesthood. We didn't have Malchus. We didn't have a king in the second Beis HaMikdash. That will not be restored till Mashiach comes. Binyamin, the children of Binyamin, are successful in restoring the Beis HaMikdash, which is Kohuna. When we say Hashem Hu Elokim on Yom Kippur, what do we always, who are we mimicking on Yom Kippur? What is the whole davening about on Yom Kippur? Who is the special person on Yom Kippur that we talk about? Not the king, and not the Gadol Hador of Torah, but rather the Kohen Gadol. He's front and center on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is his day. And that's the day of Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem Hu Elokim. Purim is a day that is very similar to everything we just talked about. You see, what happened in the Purim story? The Purim story is a story that has no open miracles. Everything is natural. And it looks very bad for the Jewish people. And things look like they're spiraling downward. And then things all of a sudden turn around. V'nahafahu, there's a complete turnaround. And all of a sudden, we're on top. Haman is destroyed. And the second Beis HaMikdash is shortly thereafter rebuilt. Purim also, you find in various sources that Purim is compared to Yom Kippur. And this is actually has become somewhat famous amongst us Jews in recent years. But Yom Kippur, the full name of Yom Kippur is Yom HaKippurim. Yom HaKippurim, you have the word Purim in there. Kippurim literally means like Purim. Kippurim, the kaf, can be a prefix which means like. Yom HaKippurim, the day like Purim. So Yom Kippur is like Purim. Yom Kippur and Purim share a very interesting aspect. Yom Kippur and Purim are one day. And that's it. You have one day to take advantage of. Chanukah, you have 8. Pesach, you have 7. Sukkot, you have 8. Even Shavuos, which is really one day, but the sacrifices that are brought on Shavuos can be brought for the next week after Shavuos as well. And anyway, Shavuos is considered to be really connected to Pesach through the Sfiras HaOmer. Rosh Hashanah is really, we keep it as 2 days. It's really supposed to be only one day, but it's kept as 2 days throughout. But Yom Kippur and Purim, you have one day to take advantage of it, and that is it. And we know how it feels on Yom Kippur. When you're getting to the end of Yom Kippur and it's Ne'ilah time, what is the main thing that we're told to do? We're told to focus. Stay focused on the day. Don't think about tomorrow. Don't think about yesterday. Don't think about what's happening next week. You've got to focus because you've only got a couple of hours left. And you're fasting. Don't think about breaking your fast. Just take advantage of the time we have now. Because this is the time to ask for forgiveness. This is the time to focus on Hashem. That's Ni'ilah. We all can appreciate what Ni'ilah is like on Yom Kippur. Purim is no different in that regard. There was a saying, there was an idiom that was said in Europe, in Yiddish. I will say it for you and I'll translate it for you. But the statement was said by poor people who would go around. They didn't have a place to eat on Purim. And as people were eating their Purim Suda, they were eating their meal, they would stop in at each home. And the saying was, Heint is Purim. Today is Purim. Morgen is ice. Tomorrow it's gone. There's no Purim tomorrow. It's today. It's not tomorrow.
Give me a drink, give me a drink, und farf mir a reis, and throw me out. What it was saying is, I'm not thinking about tomorrow, I'm not thinking about yesterday, I'm not thinking about it, now is Purim, tomorrow is not Purim anymore, I got to focus on Purim, let me take advantage of Purim right now, right this minute, because Purim is one day, and you got to take advantage of it right then. You can't say, well, later on, I'll think about it later. It's now. My wife said I should mention on Purim, don't think about the next 4 weeks. Don't think about cleaning. Don't think about Pesach. On Shushan Purim you can think about Pesach. But on Purim, think about Purim. You got to think about Purim. The truth is that Purim is 30 days before Pesach. And you're supposed to start talking about the next holiday 30 days before it. And it says that at the Purim Suda, at the Purim meal, you're supposed to talk, you're at least supposed to say one halacha, one law about Pesach. So I can't say you shouldn't mention Pesach at all. That's really a whole different talk, maybe for a future year, about the connection between Purim and Pesach, how Purim really holds in Pesach. But at any rate, Purim, you got to focus on the day at hand. And what is the day at hand? The day of Purim is this focus. If the focus of Hashem is the true God, that there's nothing else, that whatever else goes on, Hashem is running the show. Hashem is pulling the strings. Things can look bleak, v'nahafochu. Things can turn over in the blink of an eye. In the blink of an eye, things can go from being looking as bad as they can possibly be, the eradication of all the Jewish people, God forbid, and in a split second, it's totally flipped over, and instead our enemies are being wiped out, and we're on top. In the blink of an eye. Hashem can do it any time. We can sit there and think, well, how could it possibly happen? How could things just change in a second? And that's not our problem. We're not God. God is God, and He can do it. In the blink of an eye. Purim is that focus. Hashem hu Elokim, Hashem hu Elokim. I don't have doubts. I don't have any reason to suspect that things won't happen properly. That's Amalek. Amalek is doubt. Amalek is, oh, I don't know how it could be. Things are so bad. Things in Israel are falling apart. And in other parts of the world, anti-Semitism is on the rise. And who knows what's going to happen next year. And who knows... That's all Amalek. That's doubt. Hashem hu Elokim. Hashem is the true God. There's nothing to worry about. Hashem is in control. Trust in Hashem. Total, complete trust in Hashem. That's what Purim is all about. It's a very lofty goal. We can't be like that all year round. It's very difficult to be completely given over to thinking about Hashem and not worrying about anything and saying no matter what the problems are that are out there, the bigger problems, the smaller problems, the personal problems, the national problems, the communal problems, all the things that we have going on, how are things going to happen? That's for the rest of the year. For Purim, Hashem hu Elokim. Hashem hu Elokim. That's all there is. Hashem is in control. Hashem will take care of it. Hashem has many ways of taking care of things. We don't know even a drop in the ocean of what Hashem could do to change things. And all we have to do is Hashem hu Elokim. That's what Purim is all about. Purim is that focus, that singular focus of Hashem hu Elokim. That there's no doubt, no Amalek. Get that Amalek out of ourselves and think only about Hashem as being completely in control and completely in charge of what's happening. He's pulling the strings. Yeah. On Purim, the Gemara asks, why don't we say Hallel on Purim? Purim, we should be praising Hashem. Why don't we say Hallel on Purim? And the Gemara says, Kriyasa Zuhi Hilula, that the reading of the Megillah is the praise of Hashem. You see, Purim, the way we reach that level is not the way we do it on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, we do it by fasting and by acting like angels and by praying all day. That's how we reach that level on Yom Kippur. On Purim, we do it in just the opposite way. We eat, we drink, we give gifts to each other. There couldn't be a day that focuses on materialism more than Purim. And yet it's through that we think about Hashem. And we bring out that Hashem is in control of everything. Because Purim, the story of the Megillah itself, brings this point out. That everything turns over in a split second. The truth is, as uncomfortable as many people are with the notion, that is what is meant in the Gemara when it talks about the drinking. Chayv Adam Levsumi Bepuria Ad Lo Yadav in Ara Hamal Baruch Marachai. A person is obligated to become inebriated on Purim until he doesn't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. What it means is that a person reaches a point of focus of praising Hashem and thinking about the miracle of what happened on Purim to the point where there is no cursed, blessed, there's no good, there's no bad. Everything is Hashem. Everything Hashem does is for the good. I've mentioned in many of my talks that we are unable, it's impossible, in our limited view of things in this world, to see everything as good. When bad things happen, God forbid, we say, Baruch Dayan Ha'emes, blessed is the true judge. We don't say, Baruch HaTov V'Hametiv, blessed is Hashem who is good and gives good. We can't say that on bad things because we don't see the good and the bad. We only see bad when bad things happen. We say, Baruch HaTov V'Hametiv for good. The Gemara says in the future, after Mashiach comes, we will say, Baruch HaTov V'Hametiv on everything. All the bad, we'll look back and we'll say, oh, that was really good, because we'll see what the good was. On Purim, that's a day when we try to reach for that level. We can't really get there, but that's what we try, in a small way, to take from that futuristic level, that level of everything is really good. Hashem is good, and Hashem only gives good. We may not understand how it's good, but it's all good. It's all good, no matter what. Hashem hu ho Elokim, Hashem hu ho Elokim. It is through the Purim story that we do this. And the purpose of the drinking is to focus a person in that area. That's really what Chazal mean. That's why a person where the drinking is not going to focus them in that way shouldn't be drinking. The purpose of the drinking is to focus a person on this lofty goal which we really can't reach. Where the drinking strips away the facade that we live in, the falsehood that we live in. It strips away all the worries and all the thoughts of, oh, I don't know how things are going to work out, I don't know. And the drinking makes a person focus. No, everything is good, everything is great, Hashem is terrific. That's the idea of the drinking. So it's not that it's an obligation to drink just for the sake of drinking, it's to get to this level that the drinking is all about. And so it's through the Megillah that we get to that level. Other questions? Yeah?
It's true, but still the main foundation of the Yantif, of Purim was the Teshuvah. I mean, the Esther didn't, Mordechai did not push Esther to rouse the people to fast. It's the Teshuvah.
Yeah. Every Yantif is going to have all three of these aspects. There's going to be Teshuvah, there's going to be this focus of Hashem Hu HaLakim, and there's going to be the focus of Torah and everyone. And there's going to be all three crowns, Malchus, Kahuna, and Torah. In the Megillah, you have all three crowns also. Malchus, you have all over the place. Batilbash Esther Malchus, Esther wears majesty. You have HaMelech throughout the Megillah. In fact, the Megillah itself, it's considered to be a better Megillah, for every column starts with the word HaMelech, the king. You have Malchus throughout the Megillah. And Torah, you have also Kimu v'Kiblu. Chazal say that the Jews will mekabel the Torah all over again on Purim. So you're going to have aspects of everything in every Yantif. I'm bringing out the main focus of the Amalek Binyamin struggle. That's what I'm bringing out, which is Mordechai and Esther versus Haman. And that's, get rid of the suffix, be totally focused on Hashem. Yeah?
You said that Amalek is 240. Is there any correlation between that and the number of Edom who gathered around Mordechai and was that 24,000?
Hey, very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, very good. Very nice. Very nice. 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. 24,000. Yeah. I don't know. Very good. Very good. Very good. Very nice. Something to think about. Maybe that'll be 5 years from now. Very nice. Very good. Any other questions? Okay. So, for me, what this means is, then practically, that going into Purim, we have all the details that we become focused on, which we have to. So we go into Purim, the night of Purim, and we're focused on reading hearing the Megillah being read, and there we may want to attend a Chagigah, or our family members might want to attend a Chagigah, and then the next morning we also have to hear the Megillah, and then we also have to make sure to give our Shalach Manos and make sure that we do the Matanos Avion and the poor, and then we have the costumes, and we have the Seuda, and we need to be, that's how we fulfill every mitzvah. We get focused on the details. Of course, that's what we have to do. But through it all, to remain focused also on the bigger picture, on that, what am I trying to take out of this day? I'm trying to take out of this day, and I only have one day to do it. I want to take out of this day a complete conviction that Hashem is running the show. That it's not me, and it's not presidents, and it's not kings, and it's not prime ministers. It's Hashem. He's running the show, and everything is good.
in some way or other. I may not understand it. I may not have the ability to understand it. But it's all good. And on this day, on this one day, I can forget my worries. I can forget what else is going on and focus only on Hashem. That He is good and everything else is good. Hashem Hu HaElokim. We said that that tonight would be both Machshava, which would be the philosophy of Purim, which I hope we've addressed. And we also said we would cover some of the halacha of Purim as well, some of the laws of Purim. I know that some people have to get home, and if you need to leave now, you don't feel bad. It will not. It's fine. But for those who would like to stay for some of the halacha, I will discuss that now. Let me just begin with an overview of the halacha, and then I'll take questions. I think it's the best way to handle this. With Purim, so five mitzvahs? You have, these are the mitzvahs of Purim. The mitzvahs of Purim are, you know what, I'm going to step back a moment. Before Purim, let's just talk briefly about Parshas Zachar, which is this coming Shabbos. So Parshas Zachar, as you know, is read in Shul after the Torah. It's the master for this week's reading. It is the only reading which is a Torah mitzvah. To hear the Parsha of Zachar read in Shul. And that's why they're so careful to read it slowly, and we all need to listen to it. And women are obligated in Parsha Zachar just as men are. And so, you need to hear Parsha Zachar. Now, if you can't get to Shul, and many times a woman cannot get to Shul, if you cannot get to Shul to hear Parsha Zachar, then the alternative is to open up a Chumash and read it yourself. So that would be on page... What's that? No, at the end of Kisaytse. Yeah, read it out loud so you can hear it. It's just a few psukim. It's on page 1066. It's only three verses. It's only three psukim. If you can't get to Shul, then you should open up any Chumash and read these three psukim. I'll address that in a moment. So they'll go from Zachar until Lo Tishkach, which is page 1066, and that in that way you fulfill your obligation. If you cannot get to Shul, then you should read it yourselves in a Chumash. They have today, and I found out that in Beit Jacob they do this as well, that they have additional readings of Zachar throughout the day. I don't know how many there are. You can do that as well. But it is also acceptable to open up a Chumash and read these psukim here in the Chumash. And therefore, if you cannot get to Shul, this is fine. You can read it in here. Yeah?
Isn't the point to hear the Zachar said two different ways?
You mean Es Zecher and Es Zecher Amalek? You can read it two different ways also. Yeah. That's also acceptable. Yeah?
Is there a difference between hearing it with a
meaning? Yeah, well, that's
Yeah,
the best thing is to be able to get to Shul with a minyan. If you can't get to Shul with a minyan, then the alternative is to read it in the Chumash. Generally speaking, if a person has small children, then they will not be coming to minyan. Right? So, then that's fine. They should read it in the Chumash. If a person is there a time limit? You should say it on Shabbos. This Shabbos you should say it. If you don't say it on Shabbos, you can say it another day, but better to say it on the same Shabbos that everybody else is saying it. Oh yeah, no, anytime on Shabbos. Preferably do it in the morning, because that's before you get involved in anything else. You shouldn't forget. Zachar. You should remember. That's a part of the fun.
Yeah.
So there is an alternative to come to hear the morning reading of Purim by Avo Amalek, which is a different reading. Some say you can fulfill your obligation with that. Some say you can fulfill your obligation with that. That is a matter of debate, and so that would also be a way of doing it if you'd like. If that's what you're going to do, I suggest to read this yourself and then to hear the one on Purim also. Yeah. Okay. So that is Zachar. Now for Purim, there are several mitzvos. Everybody, including women, have to hear the Megillah read both at night and during the day. That's twice. You have to hear the Megillah read both times, at night and during the day, from beginning to end. So you can't miss words. So coming in the middle of a reading doesn't help you. You got to be there from the beginning to the end and hear the entire thing, both night and morning. That's one mitzvah. Another mitzvah is that you have to do Shalach Manos, you have to do Matanos Le'Avyonim, and you have to do the Seuda. Those are the other three mitzvahs. So let's take each of these things separately. Megillah, Shalach Manos,
Matanas Avionim and the Seuda. So Megillah, the best thing is to hear Megillah with a minyan. If you can't do that, and many times again, it's not possible to do that, then they have many readings. And there's a schedule with many readings in the evening and in the morning, and people who can't get out of the house, there are people who do the mitzvah of going to people's homes to read for them, and that's all very good to do. If you, for whatever reason, cannot make the shul readings, and you need a special reading, you should contact, I believe, Rabbi Feinlich is the one who is coordinating the readings of the Megillah, and that will be the thing to do. But you need to hear from beginning to end. Now, when you're listening to the Megillah, just for a moment, when you're listening to the Megillah, you may miss a word. Especially when they bang Haman, you may miss a word. So if that happens, you should read that word to yourself in the Chumash that you have in front of you. And you should catch up to the reader, to the Baal Kriya. So that you missed a word, read that word and catch up to where he's up to, and then continue listening to him as he's reading. Yeah?
That's sort of related to what I was going to ask. Well, first, when you read the word, do you have to read it out loud, or
Just loud enough for yourself to hear it.
Okay. What if you came, let's say, a few minutes late, you came 5 minutes late, and then you already started the Megillah reading at shul, could you wait until the next Megillah reading and listen to that first 5 minutes word?
That's a very good question.
From beginning to end?
That's a very good question. The Mishnah actually addresses this and says that's no good, because you can't hear the Megillah backwards. You have to hear it in order, beginning to end. But Skander was asking, can you listen to the chapters 3 through 10 and then 1 and 2? Right, now you've got to hear from 1 through 10 in order to be straight. Now the Megillah at night, you can't start to hear it until after Shabbos is over. That's, no readings are before that time anyway. In the Megillah during the day, you could do it any time during the day. You can even hear it 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But most people don't want to do that because as the day goes on, you have many other things that happen, and you may end up not hearing the Megillah. So you want to try to get it done as early as you can in the day, if possible. Any questions on Megillah? Yeah.
Can anyone read it to you, or does it have to be a rabbi?
Anybody can read it to you, preferably a man. Preferably a man. There's a difference of opinion what exactly the obligation of women is for Megillah, and therefore it's preferable man. If it has to be a woman, then it's okay too. Anything else?
Above bar mitzvah.
Right. A man above bar mitzvah, not an under bar mitzvah age boy.
Yeah, the other thing is, if you don't really understand Hebrew the whole way, do you get any merit for reading English?
Well, you get merit for hearing the Hebrew without understanding it. It's worthwhile to read the English because the whole point is to know what's going on.
Right.
But the mitzvah is to hear the words being read, even if you don't understand them.
So I shouldn't be really reading Hebrew, the English as he's reading a Hebrew word.
You could scan it with your eyes if you'd like, as long as you're not going to miss him here. You're not going to miss hearing any words. You've got to make sure you hear every word that he says. But you could be scanning the English, but don't say the words. Don't say the English words. Just listen. One should not talk in general during the Megillah reading because you'll miss words that are being said, and you have to hear every word that is being said. Anything else about Megillah? Okay, Shalach Manos, the obligation is to give one Shalach Manos. The bare bones obligation is to give one Shalach Manos to one person. That Shalach Manos should consist of two items. As long as it's two items, they do not have to have a different bracha, they could be the same bracha, but two items, as long as they're different items. So two apples would not be good. But an apple and an orange would be good. Two different items is acceptable. As long as it's two different items for Shalach Manos to one person, and you will fulfill your obligations. Drinks also are good. You can give wine and grape juice might be the same thing, so I wouldn't do that. But wine and beer, wine and iced tea, whatever it is. Okay, whatever it is. So I was saying you can be yotze with drinks as well. That is the obligation. Yeah.
That person doesn't have to be a barabbas.
The person you're giving to? The person giving to preferably should also be above barabbas mitzvah. Yes. Women should not give shalach manos to men, and men should not give shalach manos to women. Women should give to women, and men should give to men. Now, that means if your family is giving to a family, that's fine. But specifically, a woman should not give to a man should not give to a woman.
So you don't need
Mizonis. No. 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 But the food must be, food or drink, must be usable that day. Meaning, you should give it ready to eat or ready to drink. In other words, let's say a mix, you should not do that. I mean, you can include it, but the two items, you can include 10 items if you want, and then you can give whatever you want. But you have to have at least two items that are ready to eat or drink right away. And so it shouldn't be, I remember one time somebody gave us a shalach manos. It was the ingredients for a soup. And one time we got the ingredients for a pizza, which is nice, but it doesn't fulfill the obligation of shalach manos. They knew that, and they included two other things also. It was just a nice, it was a cute thing to do. But it has to be ready to eat or ready to drink right away, two items. Any other questions on that? In shalach manos. Now you can give as many as you like, but the bare bones obligation is one. And should be done sometime throughout Purim day. Yeah.
Aren't you not supposed to give it directly?
Preferably, you do fulfill your obligation if you give it directly. But preferably, you should do it through a shliach, through an agent. Apparently it makes it like a nicer gift. But no, the agent can be whoever you want.
Okay.
The agent can be whoever you want. You can send some. Yeah, it's just like right. It's like it makes it like a nicer thing to give it to. Yeah. No, it just makes it nicer to do it through an agent.
Where does this come from?
What? It's in the Megillah. The Megillah says that Mordechai and Esther, they established the day as the day of Mishloach Manos, Ish L'Re'ehu. Giving gifts of food items, one to the other. It's to engender a sense of unity over Purim. Yeah, yeah. Wait, there's another thing about Shalach Manos. That... I don't remember. Oh yes, the shalach manos needs to be commensurate with the person you're giving it to. Meaning that if you give, when I was a bachur in yeshiva, so you know, yeshiva bachur will do anything to avoid spending any kind of money, and because they didn't have any. And so I remember we used to talk about giving a raisin and a Hershey's kiss. Right? That's two items. The problem is that it has to be on the level, the kavod, the honor of the shalach manos has to correspond to the person you're giving it to. So it doesn't have to be, you know, elaborate, but to give a box of raisins to, you know, to someone, you know, an adult, you know, I don't know if that would be, nice enough. You know, it has to have some kind of a sense of a nice gift to the person. Matanos la'avyonim, the money to the poor, you have to give to two different poor people. So here not one, but you have to give to two different poor people. And in this case, it doesn't matter. Men can give to women, women can give to men. And although we generally give money, you can give food. You can fulfill this obligation with food. It doesn't have to be money. It has to be something that the poor person can use on Purim. So money he can use on Purim, and food he can use on Purim. But it's got to be something that he can make use of on Purim day. So either food or money. And so, you need to give to two poor people. Yeah.
You can't give the check on Purim.
Well, you can. Well, you. Okay. Okay. This is some. Well.
But I mean, if you give the check for Israel, yeah. By the time you get the check.
Right. So what those who collect the here, you have to have a little trust in the person collecting the money. See, anybody collecting the money should know the rules. And what they generally do is the person collecting the money calls somebody in Eretz Yisrael who lays out the amount of money corresponding to the amount of money they collected. So if they collected $1,000, they call someone in Eretz Yisrael and say, okay, we've collected $1,000, I'll send it to you, I'll put it in the mail today, and then they lay out the money and then they get paid back after Purim. But they are your shliach, they are your agent to give the amount of money that you wrote in the check to give it out. Now when you give it to these organizations that are collecting money, so then as long as you've given more than a dollar, even more than 50 cents, then you're giving it to more than one poor person, because they don't only give it to one poor person, they spread it out. So you have fulfilled your obligation of giving it to two poor people, even though you only wrote one check, because that organization gives to several people. Although there was a person, one of my fellow rabbis was collecting money for a specific person that he knows needs the money, and so I gave to him, but I realized that I'm only halfway done, because that's only one poor person. The money needs to be given out on Purim. So even though the collections are already going on now, but they don't give out the money till Purim day. So again, you can give the money today to your agent, to the person collecting the money, but they'll give it out on Purim. But if you know of a poor person, giving the money today will not fulfill your obligation. You got to wait till Purim day. Anything else about Matanos Lavyonu? Generally speaking, it is better to spend more money on Matanos Lavyonim than on Shalach Manos. That's sometimes hard to do if you have a lot of obligations with Shalach Manos, you feel you have to give a lot of people, but if you can, you should try to spend more money on the poor than on Shalach Manos. The poor people need it, and then therefore that would be the better place to put your money. If you're spending a lot of money on these things, it would be better to put more money into the Matanos Lavyonim. The Seuda of Purim, the meal of Purim, there is an obligation to have one meal. Unlike every Yontif, where there's an obligation to have two meals, and Shabbos, there's an obligation to have three meals, on Purim, there's an obligation to have one meal. That meal has to be during the day of Purim, not the night of Purim. Meaning that this year, Saturday night, if you have a big meal, you have not fulfilled your obligation. You have to have it sometime during Sunday, and the bulk of the meal has to be before sundown. That's why they're starting the shul meal at 5 o'clock. Sundown is somewhere around, 6:30? 6:30. So by the time you get to 6:30, the bulk of the meal will have been served. Once the bulk of the meal is served, you can stretch all you want into the night. They can have singing, dancing, etc. into the night, which is fine. But the bulk of it needs to be during the day. Now, you could do it in the morning if you wish. You could do it, you could wake up in the morning and have a big breakfast, and that could be your Purim Seuda. You could do it that way also. But it should be a real Seuda, like on Shabbos. It should be whatever you normally consider to be a big meal, whether there's several courses, or whether it's just, whether you eat challah, or you eat bread, or whatever it is. But it should be not just a bowl of cereal. It should be something significant, the way you would eat like a Shabbos meal or a Yontif meal. That's the way the Purim Seuda should be on Purim. You can be creative all you want, but it should have an element of being better than a regular weekday meal.
I seem to recall, and I forgot to look it up, so I'll ask you, that I once had read or learned that one should not eat before hearing the Megillah in the evening. Now, does that mean not eat?
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up.
I mean, can one eat?
Okay, very good. That's a very good question. Very good question. I want to answer that. What's your question?
Is there a minimum amount of people on the Seuda to make it a Seuda?
No. You can have as many as you want, although it's brought down, I think this is intuitive, that a Seuda by yourself is not nearly as enjoyable as with other people. So it's preferable to do it together. It doesn't have to be a lot of people, but that's preferable. But you can fulfill it yourself. You live alone, you can do it yourself. Just it's nicer with a lot of people. Now, the question of eating before Megillah, which is a very good question, and this comes up for anybody who can't go to the first reading and has to wait, both night and morning, you're not supposed to eat a meal until, now this is even a small meal, until after you've heard the Megillah. Now you're allowed to eat a small meal, like a snack, you're allowed to have. But you're not supposed to have a real meal until after you've heard the Megillah. So if you're going to go to the 10 o'clock at night, Saturday night reading, so until then, you can't have a big meal. Meaning, from the time Shabbos is over, of course, until Shabbos is over, you could eat whatever you want. But once the nighttime comes in, and now it's time to read the Megillah, then you should not have a full meal until then. What's considered a full meal? A full meal is considered to be an egg's worth of bread, or an egg's worth of wine. That's considered. So you can snack. You can have fruits. You can have vegetables. You can even have less than an egg's worth of cake or cookies or something like that. But one should not have what we would consider a meal before hearing the Megillah. As I said, that's both night and day, both things. Now, if a person is stuck for whatever reason, they can't hear the Megillah until the afternoon of Purim day. This year, it's rarely a problem. Many times when it's a weekday, there are people who work who can't hear the Megillah to the afternoon. So then they should ask Shiloh, they should speak to the rabbi about it. But generally speaking, one should not eat before hearing the Megillah. One should not eat a real meal before hearing the Megillah. Any other questions about this? Okay, you have a question? No.
You mentioned the fast before.
Okay, good, that's tomorrow. It's tomorrow. That's really the first thing. Okay, so the fast tomorrow, Tainus Esther, of course, usually it's the day before Purim, but since this year the day before Purim is Shabbos, so we bump it back to Thursday, And so we fast tomorrow. The fast begins, I think, at 5:54. Okay. And it ends, I think, 7:09. Okay. So so you could get up early and eat, but once tomorrow morning is the fast. You can't eat all day until 7:09. Once the fast is over, then unlike typically on a Purim, where the fast ends with the reading of the Megillah, you have to wait till after the Megillah to break your fast. This year, there's a break, meaning that Thursday night, right away at 7:09, you can eat. This is the most lenient of the six fast days. The six public fast days that we have, this one is the most lenient, and therefore anybody who is not feeling well, or another has any other reason not to fast, should speak to a rabbi about it, because this is the one that there are the most leniencies to not fast. But if you're feeling regular, you're feeling strong, you're okay, then you need to fast tomorrow from 5:54 to 7:09. In general, with these fasts that start in the morning, so as you know, you can go to sleep and wake up early to eat if you'd like. But the only catch is you have to have in mind when you go to sleep that you plan on waking up. If you go to sleep at 10 o'clock tonight and you didn't plan on getting up before 5:54, and you happen to wake up at 5:30, you can't eat. Because when you went to sleep with having in mind that now I'm going to fast as soon as I wake up. And so you have to, you should have in mind, therefore I always have in mind, just in case. Yeah.
I heard here in Israel, and if you're outside of Jerusalem, then you fast on Thursday, but then you want to travel to Jerusalem, what happens with the Purim inside the wall?
The fast doesn't change.
So Thursday, no matter where you are?
Yeah. Yeah, the fast is going to be, I'm pretty sure. Is that right? Is that wrong? Did I say that wrong? Yeah, you don't fast on the 14th. You fast on the 13th regardless.
Well,
yeah.
In Jerusalem, when Purim is on the train,
yeah, but this fast is still, the fast is still the same as outside of Jerusalem. The difference is...
They would fast on Sunday, the day before, and they would still fast on Thursday?
Right. Right. That's right. Yeah, the 13th of Adar is the fast regardless.
Yeah.
What's that?
Normally, not this year, but is there a law?
It has to start after it's nightfall.
So that's why they don't wait even a few minutes. Do people ever eat between the fast and the Megillah reading?
They shouldn't. They shouldn't. I mean, you can have a small snack, but you can't have a meal.
No, I understand that, but I mean, when they're at school, they wouldn't have a...
No, they usually go right into it. They figure everybody wants to come home and eat, so they just go right into it. Okay, we should have a Freilich and Purim. Just to make it clear, that I know there was a lot of confusion, we have three pre-Pesach classes, all on the next three Wednesdays coming up. All are from 8 to 9, and they're in the flyer, in the Shabbos flyer, and in the bulletin, the topics of the pre-Pesach classes, from 8 to 9, both the 7th, the 14th, and the 21st of March.
And isn't the one next week, the 12th, going to be downstairs?
Right, the one next week will be in the boardroom downstairs. That's right, not up here. They're all machshava. We took a poll and everybody wanted machshava.
I want machshava.
Oh, so it is.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought you were expressing displeasure.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.